Hello, welcome and thank you for joining us and listening to our podcast, The God Beyond the Bible. Our podcast is released weekly each Friday. The content of each episode is based on the questions and curiosities we all have about God and the Bible. Many of our topics are considered taboo in the minds of the mainstream church. You will find our discussions to be, I think, refreshing and often far from traditional. But we don't just skirt around these complex issues, but confront them head on, and not in the way you're used to hearing them discussed on typical Christian talk shows. I'm Alan Rowland, creator and host of The God Beyond the Bible. As of the launch of this podcast, I've been a pastor for more than 35 years. My co-host is my daughter, Trayson, and our engineer co-producer is my daughter, Tabitha. Our mission is to encourage our audience, along with us, to open our minds to the reality that God is simply too big to be fully explored or experienced by the reading and studying of a single ancient work. In short, the Bible's not the sum of God, and to think this is to limit what He has done, is doing, and what He will do in our future. So with introductions made, thank you for listening, and let's dive into the topic of the day.
Okay, welcome seekers to podcast number 69 of God Beyond the Bible, a podcast made by seekers and for seekers. As always, thanks for listening, commenting, and sharing our little podcast with others whom you think may benefit from our labor of love for truth. In these days when the ancient experiences of those seeking to know God in the Bible seems to be increasingly substituted for a personal relationship with the Almighty. Let us say again, we are not on a mission to discredit the value of having access to our Bible. It is a very important tool in our pursuit of God. But if it is the only tool in our toolbox, how are we to utilize His promise of His Spirit to teach us all things in the here and now?
Well said.
Definitely. So our shout outs this week are to Shauna and our listeners in Turkey. We're glad to have you guys on board.
Thanks, and hi,
guys.
Kirk.
Yes, and always hi to Kirk.
Hey, Kirk. Okay, and I've got the quote of the week. Not all those who wander are lost.
I like that.
And that's J.R. Tolkien?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay, so last episode, we very slowly eased into the cool waters of the shallow end of the pool concerning the book of Revelation. We realize we've spent a great deal of time focusing on the Olivet Discourse, or Jesus' teaching the disciples to be prepared for the fall of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple. The reason we spent so much time on this topic is twofold. First, to see that Jesus was clearly and solely speaking of an event that would occur within the lifespan of some of those listening. And secondly, as we will discover, that the book of Revelation is a detailed breakdown of the same soon-to-happen event.
All right, so let's dive into segment one. If this is the first time you've listened to our podcast, we strongly urge you to back up and listen to episodes 66, 67, and 68 that will enable you to more easily navigate this episode. With so much pertinent background, it's not feasible to recap all of the important points that led up to today's episode.
However, we do wish to begin by pointing out two essential keys to reading the book of Revelation. The first is the theme that runs the entire prophecy, and that is the urgency of the prophecy because of the shortness of time before it is to come to pass. Now, last episode, we ended by reading the first three verses of the opening of the book of Revelation, and then the last two verses of the final chapter. In the first three opening verses, we are told the prophecy must quickly or shortly come to pass and is comprised of things that must soon happen. And the final verse reiterates this urgency by saying, "Surely I come quickly," and that's repeated over and over through the book.
It is. This is a good time to raise a question or two. If quickly means a long time and soon happen means a couple thousand years in the future, and this generation means a far distant future generation, and some standing here shall not taste death till all is fulfilled means you will all be long dead before any of this ever happens, then how is the reader to take anything that Jesus said seriously?
And I know this is a hard thing to bring up, but if we can't trust what Jesus says, doesn't that call everything that we believe?
Everything's in question. If we can't take what the master said, if we cannot take him at his word, and I think, you know, I just didn't realize how bad this thing had gotten out of hand, of this futuristic tribulation that's somewhere in the future, and how how much it's just completely got out of control, and even to the point, and, you know, I guess a really awakening, and it's not just recent, you know, Tabitha read that C.S. Lewis quote mm-hmm. a few episodes ago, and that still just rings in my mind. That is just the blatant egotism just blows me away that we will say, well, Jesus just didn't know.
Yeah. So it's our humble opinion that Jesus said exactly what he meant and meant exactly what he said. And the disciples rightly understood him in this manner and wrote and taught with the same urgency instilled in them by their master. No matter how well read, formally educated in theology, or how many letters follow their name, no one has the authority to tell us that Jesus was instrumental in perpetuating a false sense of urgency in his listeners and followers concerning the fall of Israel as a nation and the fall of the capital city of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple and his appearance and rescue of those believers who endured the great tribulation that began mid AD 66 and concluded with the destruction of the temple by the Gentiles in AD 70.
And let me go ahead and add right now, guys, after this one, boys and girls, listeners, after this one, we've got one more that we're doing, kind of delving into the book of Revelation. And then we're going to talk about this misconception of a second coming.
Yeah.
That is also part of this whole big deal, and that Jesus never talked about. He really talked about, and I'm talking about in the next episode I haven't written yet. It hasn't been written. So anyway, so let's get this, and we're going to be talking about this more, but this was the Great Tribulation. Mm-hmm. It's clear. Jesus told them, this is the Great Tribulation. We're going to talk about that more. I'm really getting ahead of ourselves here. But anyway, let's just keep with this theme. Let's remember this theme that's running all the way through this book of Revelation. It's going to happen fast. It's happened quickly. It's coming soon. And it's going to unfold really fast. And it's going to be bad.
But a lot of the misconception comes when you open your Bible to the book of Revelation and the date it says it was written. That throws everyone off.
It
does. To say it was written 25 years after the fall.
Yeah.
But the reason I brought that up is I was doing...
Well, you're talking about Revelation in, some say, AD 95.
AD 95.
When really the date falls more in AD 65. But I'm going to make a point in here that's going to show you that this was written before. But
sure.
let's go ahead. But go ahead with your thought.
Well, no, I was just saying, I was reading to try to figure out when we made this move and decided this was written in AD 95.
And about 350 AD...
You think so?
About 340 or 350 at the count. I think the Council of Nicaea then,
actually,
when the Roman Church was forming it. But you
to,
found it before that?
No.
If I'm wrong,
but this
I'm just
it was actually around AD 180, and it was by a theologian.
So the doctrine got started then before it moved in. Before it moved,
what the earliest I could find.
But my research showed it that it became widespread during the Roman Church.
Sure.
The Catholic Church. But go ahead. I'm interested in hearing this.
But in AD 180, this theologian
so this
named
is
Irenaeus.
Let's just get a time perspective. This is 110 years after the fall of Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But he's the one that I first found, and I may be, there may be some before, where he wrote in one of his essays, one of his books, that John wrote this in AD 95 while he was on the Isle of Patmos. The reason that he says this is because he feels like he was very close to the teachings of Jesus himself. Like mm-hmm. he kind of had an inside track because supposedly one of John's apostles, Polycarp,
uh-huh.
he was a student of him. Irenaeus was a student of Polycarp,
okay.
who was a direct apostle of John. But he says that he's the one who wrote that the apocalyptic vision was seen was seen not very long ago, almost in our own generation, at the close of the reign of Domitian. Excuse me. So he's the one who kind of started this whole, because up until then, they pretty well understood that, you know, this was written
this was written for the people of Judea.
And,
in
Polycarp
that fall.
Was actually martyred during the fall of Jerusalem.
Oh, was he?
He was in one of the seven churches. I can't remember if it was Ephesus or Sardis, and during that time he was, because while it was the fall of Jerusalem, there were massive riots and fighting going on elsewhere.
Well, there were all over the land.
Yes, and one of the other cities where Polycarp was a teacher, he was actually martyred during that period of time at the fall of Jerusalem.
Am I five now?
You are.
Okay. with these dates confirmed, now we're talking about that AD, mid AD 66 yes. to AD 70 was the fall. And we're going to talk a little more. Remember those dates. With these dates confirmed by the historian Josephus and others, it isn't hard to see why this period is repeated over and over again with phrases like 3.5 years, 42 months, 1260 days, a time, times, and a half time, all used throughout the book of Revelation concerning the events that must soon come to pass.
I just figured out today what a time, time, and half a time even meant.
Yeah, it's...
One plus two plus a half.
Yeah.
3.5. Time, I had no idea. Times that was and a half time,
yeah. And okay. Speaking of years, it was 1 year plus 2 years plus a half a year, 3.5 years. Almost exactly how long the siege on Jerusalem lasted. Mid AD 66, and the temple fell early in AD 70. 3.5 years. Reckon that's just coincidence?
Okay, but before we get way ahead of ourselves, let's pull back and let's take a look at how the book starts. We've established that John clearly intended the recipients and readers of the prophecy to read everything in it with the understanding that what they were reading pertained to them in the generation and age in which they lived, and to read it with the surety that it would happen within the normal lifespan of most of them.
And let's be frank here. If you were writing a
letter to Jesse, you be frank.
Okay. If you were writing a letter to descendants 2,000 or more years in the future, wouldn't you mention that somewhere in your letter?
Yeah. You wouldn't say, must soon come to pass.
Yeah.
Write down these things that must soon happen.
You would say something like, write these things down because tell your children and your children.
What did he tell Daniel when he wrote them down?
These things aren't for your
He said, close it up.
Yes.
Write it in a book and close it up and don't give it to anybody.
He did, didn't
yes, he?
Yes,
he told Daniel, said, it's not for your age, Daniel, close it up. Unlike, he told John, write it down and tell him it's about to happen.
Yeah, tell him now. Okay, so this may be a bit premature, but we would like to point out one more thing that because of our theological brainwashing, we seem to ignore. Throughout all the tribulations laid out in the book of Revelation, it's centered around the temple. In short, the temple is still standing until the near the end of the prophecy, which can only mean that John wrote this before and not after the destruction of the temple. So to get around this obvious fact, those who desire to place this prophecy as still unfulfilled create a fanciful scenario of some future temple still not in existence today as the focus of the prophecy.
Did you, that when that jumped out at me, I thought, wait a minute. Oh. Why would he write that about some, he can give it to people that, where the temple was still standing.
Well, and as I was studying, and it reads in Revelation 11, if you guys noticed, John is told to go take a measuring stick and go measure the temple.
Measure the temple, yeah.
And it's, you know, it's a really common thing, but you see it in a lot of the future, you know, people who believe that
The book of Revelation hasn't come to pass yet.
Uh-huh. The futurist theology. You see a lot of, well, you have to watch Israel because when the temple's rebuilt, then everything's going to fall into place and start.
The problem with this future fantasy temple is that it would mean the urgent soon to come to pass prophecy of the Revelation would have no meaning at all to the generation of that day. In other words, why then was the prophecy given to that particular generation and that particular period of time if it did not pertain to them?
I couldn't come up with a plausible answer for that.
So it would make it in the Bible?
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. In short, the book of Revelation is centered around the land of Judah, the city of Jerusalem, and the temple because it pertains strictly to that period and people. They would have no more concern of some other temple that would exist thousands of years in the future than you or I would have of a supposed asteroid that is predicted to collide with Earth 2,000 years from now.
And I kind of got that from Tracen, and she said it a couple, and it's right, yeah. Because I use the global warming thing, and that's too hot. I'll just kind of leave that alone. And let me go ahead and say something here in the episode that just released there in about June the 5th or whatever it was, the first one that released in June. I made some statements that sounded like that it sounded like I said a billion people could get in Jerusalem, a million.
Oh,
It sounded like a billion to me. I did not say a billion. I said a million people could get inside the walled fortress of Jerusalem, mm-hmm. not the temple walls, because the wall was around the whole city.
Right.
And
right.
over. And the reason we know that over a million people, because every time the Passover came, more than a million people came to celebrate the Passover.
Mm-hmm. And they all fit.
And they all fit in there. So, and we're going to be talking in later episodes of how many people were carried out and died in there.
Oh, wow.
That were carried out the gate. So anyway, that's true. Why would 2,000 years ago, you get this urgent message that was for 2,000 or 3,000 years in the future, and talk about a temple and some futuristic, non-existent temple.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Listen, folks, God allowed the Jewish polity, the Jewish economy, the Jewish way of life, the Jewish religion, the old covenant people to fall once and for all.
Yes.
That's not to say, and we'll talk about it later, it's not to say they may not put up some facsimile of the temple again.
Right, right.
But it's got nothing to do with this prophecy. It has absolutely nothing to do with this prophecy.
Well, with that thought, please allow us to pause and regroup, and we'll return with part two.
And back with segment two. Though it may seem that we're doing a lot of jumping ahead of ourselves, our desire is to establish a single theme for the book of Revelation. And that is that it was written for and pertained to the people living in the land of Judah or Judea, more specifically Jerusalem, and the focus of religious life of that day, which was the Jewish temple. It was written to alert those of that day to the impending tribulation for those who lived in that day and that region. The symbols and clues that we today find so enigmatic, and we look for everything from Hitler to who knows what to fill in the blanks, would have been very easy to interpret for those who lived in that generation and age who read the prophecy.
Mm-hmm. Though difficult for us of our modern generation to understand, it is much less confusing when we understand that it was written for a specific people in a specific period of time to whom the events predicted would have been easily connected to the current events of that age. Again, most of our difficulty occurs when we try to force an interpretation on the prophecy that does not apply in the least.
And that goes right back to the theme.
It does.
It's going to come quickly. It's soon to happen. And that, when you force any other interpretation, then you're forcing Jesus to be wrong.
And you know, I got really upset. The first time I really ever heard any of this theology was about 5 or 6 years ago. And the guy made a statement, and it ticked me off so bad, because he goes, well, none of this applies to you. Unless you were a Jew living in 60 AD, this has nothing to do with you, so let it go.
And that hacked you off, didn't it?
It did. It made me really mad.
Yeah.
And as I started, you know, coming
nobody
more
has,
into this
nobody
growing,
has promoted that erroneous and forced that interpretation on there. But the thing of it is, you can't fill in all the blanks. And we're going to talk about in probably the next episode, and I'm stealing from James Stuart Russell. He won't mind. He wrote this in 1850. But
you don't think he's listening?
I don't think he's probably, well, he may be, I don't know. But I don't know if they have podcasts wherever he is. But anyway, listen. He talked about how, and I'm getting ahead of plumb an episode ahead, but we talk about everybody's looking for the key to the book of Revelation. Mm-hmm. And you know what the amazing thing is? The key is hanging right by the door when he said, must soon happen.
Yes. Yeah.
I come quick. The key was there all the time hanging by the door, and we're trying to dig under and climb over and everything else. And there was the key in plain sight all the time.
So it's not to say that there will never be another temple built in Jerusalem. There's no doubt that the Jewish people would love to reinstate the old covenant style of worship. But even if they someday do, a far distant facsimile of the temple would have no meaning to the people of that era who had a real existing temple at that time when the prophecy was given.
And I think Tabitha said it during the break about Tim LaHaye, and he said, well, that's just wishful thinking, or people wanting to...
That's people wanting to put it when you want to say that this was referring to the...
Or before the temple, that Revelation was written before the temple.
Then that's people just wanting to fit it into their own beliefs. You're just making it fit how you want it to.
And is that not exactly what we've done for 2,000 years? We forced an interpretation. We're forcing square pegs and round holes and trying to make them fit where they don't fit. And it's amazing how easily they fit when you use the key.
Yes, and I have been as guilty as anyone. Just so the listeners know, we're not above anyone.
No. I have promoted that false theology as much as any because it was forced on me, and I was brainwashed by it. And for years, I taught it, but I never was completely comfortable. I thought, well, this is just not really making sense. Why would Jesus say quickly?
Yeah.
And they say, oh, because 1,000 years is as a day, and a day is as a thousand years. And so, you know, that is quick to God. No, he was writing to real people. In God time, if he was talking to God, he could say, well, it's going to happen quick, and it could be 2,000 years. In people time,
that's not very fast.
2,000 or 3,000 years is not quick. And I think Jesus is smart enough to know that. In fact, I know he is. Now, let's move ahead. The book of Revelation is clearly addressed to a certain group of people, just as the book of Romans, Corinthians, Philippians, Ephesians, Galatians, etc., etc., were from a real person addressed to a real group of people living in a real time, and the content was directed to them and their specific and unique set of circumstances and challenges. The same is true of the book of Revelation. It's clearly addressed to 7 specific churches that existed in John's day, made up of real life people. It was addressed to them, and every word pertained to them, not just the first 3 chapters of the book. Therefore, we properly understand the book, we must read it as though we were a real person who, in part, made up the group to which it was specifically addressed. Now, here's another amazing thing. That whole land was in utter chaos and destruction.
Mm-hmm.
Why would John write it to those 7 churches that are told to get out of there?
Yeah.
If it was after the destruction, why would he write it to those 7? Because folks, after the destruction and the fall of Jerusalem, there was absolute chaos in the land of Judah, and it was a smoking battleground of dead bodies.
Yeah. Revelation 1:4 begins with John to the 7 churches which are in Asia. Then John goes on to name them in Revelation 1:11, which reads, I am Alpha and Omega, the first and the last. What thou seest, write in a book and send it unto the 7 churches which are in Asia, unto Ephesus, and unto Smyrna, and unto Pergamos, and unto Thyatira, and unto Sardis, and unto Philadelphia, and unto Laodicea.
Okay, I want to read this for a minute.
Okay.
Because this kind of made the churches seem more like real places to me. The 7 churches, did you know that Paul was in prison near the meeting place of the church of Ephesus in a place called the Pauline Tower? Thanks to our Catholic friends who have preserved it all of these years.
Wow.
You can still see it today.
Now Ephesus was an epicenter of commerce. Yes. It was a wealthy epicenter, but go ahead.
The Catholics actually deemed the Church of Smyrna as one of the first legitimate churches because it could be traced back to John himself. In Pergamos, the seat of Satan that's referred to in the book of Revelation was the altar of Pergamon, which resembled a great throne. In Thyatira, Paul's friend Lydia is believed to have been a leader in that church.
Mm-hmm. From the book of Acts.
Mm-hmm. Sardis, the synagogue where they believe early Christians met, still stands to this day. And Philadelphia is actually very close to Sardis, and it's still a largely Catholic city to this day. And Paul not only writes greetings to the Church of Laodicea in the book of Colossians, but even refers to a Laodicean letter that we do not have
today.
Yeah.
Said the letter, so right. And then he said, real. I want you to read the letter I sent to Laodicea, and we don't have that today. So, before we go any farther, let's pause and let this sink in. John identifies himself, just like Paul does in his letters. Mm-hmm. And he identifies those to which he is addressing the prophecy. In verse 11, Jesus didn't instruct John to send each church only a little snippet that was included in each personal message. He instructed John to send the whole of the book or the prophecy to all 7 churches. Not just a bit of the first 3 chapters, but the entire book containing the entire prophecy.
without applying any preconceived ideas that these seven churches were merely symbolic of some future church or symbolic of successive stages representing the church throughout the ages, we will discover that this entire prophecy was, number one, a prophecy that would fully come to pass in a very near period of time, and number two, is addressed to a specific group of people who existed in that very period of time in which it was written and applied to.
And there are many today that have adopted a theory that since the churches are only mentioned in the first three chapters of the book, that only that...
Tim LaHaye.
That only that part of the book applies to them. Jesus clearly said otherwise in verse 11 that we just read. He instructed John to send the whole prophecy to each of the seven churches. Let's put it this way. If you were a participant in the church of Ephesus and it was announced that your group was a recipient of this entire writing, would you read only those few lines that specifically named your group and blow off the rest of the book as not important? Or would you take it to mean that it would affect you personally in the very near future?
So, with that thought, and let me just answer that. You would take it very personally, and you'd read every line, and you would understand most of it, and as it unfolded right before your eyes, you would go, oh.
I think I would probably, if I got a letter that was essentially a message from Jesus through one of his apostles, I believe I'd probably have it about memorized before I was done reading it.
Be copying it and distributing it and everything else. Well, please allow a moment for us to regroup and quickly return. And we don't mean a few thousand years in the future. We mean quickly.
And just as promised, we returned quickly. All right, enough of that. We just thought it'd be a neat way to make our point. We're going to move ahead. We think we have very well established that John wanted the recipients of his book to experience the urgency of the nearness of fulfillment of the prophecy and clearly stated who those intended recipients were.
There are a couple more important things to note in the first few verses of chapter 1 before we move on to the specific instructions directed to each particular group. One of these is verse 7, and it reads, "Behold, he cometh with clouds, and every eye shall see him, and they also which pierced him, and all kindreds of the earth," or the land, "shall wail because of him. Even so. Amen."
Now, two things must be addressed here. One, John clearly said that Jesus was to appear, and that those who pierced him would witness his appearance. Now, let's don't get bogged down in subjective speculation here. Whether the phrase, "even those who pierced him," pertains to the Jewish leaders who pursued and perpetuated the death of Jesus, or the Roman government who carried out the sentence of crucifixion, or literally the Roman soldiers who drove the nails, pressed the crown of thorns into his head, and stuck the point of the spear into his side as he hung on the cross, John said, "He cometh with the clouds, it will be a visible appearance, and those that pierced him would be there to witness it." This statement is consistent with, "This generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled." Some of those who were responsible for the crucifixion of Jesus Christ would live to see him appear with the clouds. And I'll just almost guarantee you there's some of those that ran to the mountains and the catacombs and begged for them to fall on them and hide them from the face of the Lamb. What do you bet?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, now let's address the second part. Here is where translators once again, either with or without intent, made the English text say something different than those of that day would have understood it. It is again due to the translation of a single word being translated differently to satisfy the whim of the translator. In the latter phrase of verse 7, our Western English Bible reads, "And all the kindreds of the earth shall wail because of him."
And it is the English word "earth" that requires our attention. Again, when we read this, we automatically interpret it to mean the whole material earth. The truth is that the word translated earth here is the Greek word spelled G-H-A-Y, or in some places we have found it spelled G-E, but and it is number 1093 in Strong's Greek Concordance. It's a word that's most commonly translated "land," as many agree it should have been in this case. However, once again, our English translators exercised their prerogative and translated it "earth" instead of "land," which causes the English reader to interpret it as the whole material earth. You don't focus on this one area. You zoom out, I guess you'd
and
say.
And some say, well, he meant the whole known world, which was the Roman Empire. But he said the land. Mm-hmm. The land. And the tribulation was not for the whole world. It was for the land.
Right.
And so this is a very important word. And guys, this appears hundreds of times in prophecy. And when it's convenient, when it'll say the G-H-A-Y, what'd you say? It's guy?
Guy, yes.
And it's G-E-U-Y, like...
It's G-H-A-Y, but they actually pronounce it guy, like the goddess Gaia.
So that's the English pronunciation of it would be guy. Okay. This word, they just used it however they wanted to use it. Now, in text that they absolutely had to use land, they translated it land.
Mm-hmm.
The amazing thing is, I don't know if I wrote it in here. I don't think I did. I think in the next one, maybe in the next episode. But it's especially clear in Luke, I think it's Luke 21, and I can't remember the verses. And they had to put it land because he said the whole land of Judah, and they had the same word. And in the next two verses down, twice, they translated it earth.
Hmm.
So you see, had the translators remained true to the context of the writing, it would have been more properly translated, all the tribes of the land shall wail because of him, instead of all the kindreds of the earth, which shifts our thoughts from the region occupied by the seven churches to the whole material earth and completely changes the interpretation. With minimal research and with the resources that have become available in the past few decades, we will discover this to be truth. Not only is this in this particular case, but wherever the word is used in the text.
Mm-hmm. Now, moving to another statement John makes that gets little, if any, attention, but speaks volumes if we read it for ourselves. In verse 9, we read, I, John, who also am your brother and companion in tribulation. John uses this particular word that was first used by our Lord Jesus in the Olivet Discourse, first appearing in our English Bible in Matthew 24:21, where he says, For then shall be great tribulation.
So it's pretty clear that John is of the opinion that at the time of the writing of the prophecy, he considers himself and the recipients of this book to be companions in tribulation.
Now hold your finger right there. If John was writing that for 3,000 years in the future, how could he say, I am your companion in tribulation, and name those churches and then say, I am your companion in tribulation?
I think we always just kind of skim over that part to move on to it.
And he used the word tribulation that Jesus first used talking about mm-hmm. the destruction of Jerusalem and the great tribulation. I'm sorry, but go ahead there.
I think in my head, honestly, I've always rationalized it. Well, John was imprisoned and he was going through a lot, so.
Well, I mean, let's be honest though. We're also kind of intimidated by the book of Revelation. Most people are. I mean, if you have a study, even I know pastors who steer away from having that, you know, mm-hmm. teaching a Bible study. And it's like it's ingrained in us. Be fearful because you don't want to misinterpret this when, guess what? We've been doing it wrong a long time.
And some of it on much on purpose.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, he considered himself the recipient and the recipients of the book that they are companions in tribulation. And that's a clear message.
It is. So the significance of this is that the term tribulation is not widely used and always seems to be associated with the end of the age. John would have been well aware that to use this term would rightly cause his readers to reflect on Jesus' use of the same term in the Olivet Discourse.
Now, this would also contribute to the urgency of the attention to be granted to this prophecy, seeing how that they were already witnessing signs of the tribulation Jesus spoke of just some 30 years earlier.
Isn't it amazing that when we lift the blindfold that has been placed on this modern believing generation and read what the book actually says, that we find its meaning and intent everything but baffling and confusing?
Yes.
When we expose those who manipulate the text to leverage control over the minds of the masses and claim to be authorities as to the intent of the writers instead of what was actually said and written, even to the degree that they believe they know more about what our Lord and Master intended to say than he did himself.
All right, so in conclusion, we are devoting so much time to this topic simply because so many misguided individuals are using these prophecies to stir up fear and frustration in our current crises. when the last thing we need is more stress, worry, and fear. In the words of Paul, finally, brothers and sisters, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of good report, if there be any virtue, if there be any praise, think on these things. And the peace of God, which passeth all understanding, shall keep your hearts and minds through Jesus Christ.
And with that said, until next time, may God's grace, peace, and love be on you, in you, and radiate out from you, each of you, from all of us here at God Beyond the Bible.
Did you enjoy listening to God Beyond the Bible? Do you have an idea for an episode? Connect with us today. Visit our website at godbeyondthebible.com, all one word, or send us an email at email@godbeyondthebible.com, or you can visit us on Facebook. Just type God Beyond the Bible into the search bar.